little while ago, I got this text from a Sparker. Said, can you please say this Sunday that it was a group of girls and women that led to the downfall of the empire? Because I'm needing some hope this Sunday. So there's your message. And just want to let you know that we are a very kind of open door kind of a church. You are welcome to send any messages to me. So this random person apparently felt so compelled. So anyway, there's your message. And that's what we're going to talk. We're going to now move to a time of communion, and thank you so much for coming. No, I'm just kidding. So, the title of my message today is called Birthing Justice. We've been going through the Bible over the last couple of weeks. We've been going through Genesis way too fast. We're going to go through Exodus way too fast as well. For those of you who are new or visiting, joining us, what the heck is this story all about? There's a lot of nitty-gritty and details that we could get into, but what we're trying to capture is this grand narrative of what's going on in these texts, and what are the main themes, what are the main perspectives and ideas that are being promulgated, that are being proposed to us. And my introduction to Exodus is going to be entitled Birthing Justice, and I hope that that title makes sense as we move forward. Here's how the book of Exodus begins. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now, a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, look, the Israelite people, with his teeth really gritted, are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians subjected the Israelites to hard servitude and made their lives bitter with hard servitude in mortar and bricks and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. Did you catch what happened? Did you see the movement? Did you get the shifts and the changes over time compacted into this very brief paragraph that I think we so often overlook because we're very excited to get to the parting of the Sea of Reeds, and we're very excited to get to the Ten Commandments, and we're very excited about this, but did you catch this? The story starts off with a political succession. There's a new king that has come. And with that political succession, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unknowns. That political succession and that new king was ignorant of the most immediate history of that particular kingdom. He did not know who Joseph was. It's already not looking very good. New king, ignorant of history. And as a result of that ignorance, the way in which this person began to rule was through fear and insecurity. The Israelite people are more powerful than we. And as goes fear and insecurity, many of you know this about our human psychology, we begin to claim wisdom, but we actually act evil. Come, let us deal shrewdly. That word shrewdly in the Hebrew is the exact same word as wise. Let us deal wisely. Let's be really thoughtful about this. Yes, I am being thoughtful, but what you're actually being is stupid and ignorant and fearful and unwise. But you are going to claim to be wise. That ignorance, that claiming of wisdom, that evil actions leads to authoritarianism and harshness. They set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they continue to exemplify foolishness and profound incompetence. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. Oh, congratulations, Pharaoh. You got the exact opposite of what you thought you were going to get. Foolishness and incompetent. And for those of you who know, ego is an incredibly strong driver.
Maybe this isn't working. I should probably change tactics.
No, you pursue even further. You grind in even deeper for further disdain and animosity. You use that to oppress your enemies. The Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. And then you culminate yourself in your position of power through state-sponsored oppression. If it is a son, kill him. If it is a daughter, she shall live. Do you see the progression? Do you see how this very brief paragraph is posing a movement, a shift, a phenomenon that has captivated the imaginations of empires and civilizations for thousands of years? And then, of course, ultimately, it ends in extreme violence. Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Take a look at this list for a second. Political succession, ignorant of history, fearful and insecure, claiming wisdom but acting evil, authoritarian and harsh, foolishness and incompetence, disdain and animosity, state-sponsored oppression, all justified, of course, leading to extreme violence. I want you to imagine yourself living in a world where this is your political reality. Think about what kind of existence this would be. When the powers that be do not govern according to good, honorable, loving, kind, compassionate, and generous principles, but govern out of ignorance, fear, insecurity, authoritarianism, harshness, incompetence. Imagine living there. This is the context of the ancient Israelites at the very beginning of the book of Exodus. Again, we're so quick to get to the miracles. Don't skip over this paragraph, my friends. I believe these authors, whoever this person was writing about the Egyptian Empire to declare, watch what happens. You know, prior to this, there was a wonderful relationship between Joseph and the Egyptian Pharaoh. If you remember the Genesis story, this is a carryover from that time. And Exodus, in a very short paragraph, begins to describe how quickly things can turn. And I would propose to you that the author of Exodus is suggesting to us that injustice is actually a process. It didn't start with complete extreme violence and state-sponsored oppression. No, it didn't start there. It started with ignorance. It started with insecurity. It began with a little bit of incompetence, saving face and ego. And it slowly and then sometimes rapidly degrades into a level of injustice and oppression and violence that is continually justified because of those small, little, incremental steps. And this, my friends, is the context. Now, we could stop there and we'd love to have a little small group powwow about this kind of phenomena. What I'd like to share with you is what the author of Exodus is pointing out that the Israelite people did in response to this. They knew, they understood this process of injustice. What did they do? How did they do that? And that random anonymous sparker who texted me earlier this week wants to know, is there any hope to be found in the midst of this? And the answer is, of course, yes. That's what these texts give us. But because we're so quick to jump to the miracles, we miss that just like there's a process to injustice, there's also a process to justice. And as much as we want the quick and easy fix for God to come down, for things to be right now, there's also a process to undo all of those elements of injustice that captivate the hearts and the minds of incompetent people. As I mentioned before, this is the distraction. Exodus is huge. We make movies out of it, and we find very strong actors with chiseled faces and big voices to play the characters. And the reality is that is really just our bias and our imposition on what we want these texts to be. The story, the narrative, is far more brilliant and subtle and audacious than we would ever expect. Because it begins with two women. It begins with the story of two women whose main responsibility for the Israelites is to care for the babies that are being born. You're telling me that this story about overthrowing one of the largest and domineering empires in the history of the world, you're going to start that story with two women that bring babies into the world? The answer, you darn right. So then the question is, why midwives? Why do you start this revolutionary story with midwives? Why would you start the story with midwives? And I'm just going to give it to you. The Exodus is actually a birth narrative. It's a story about being born and being born again. And it's a story of how birth becomes the predominant metaphor, image, picture, symbol of how people who are under oppression can overthrow that oppression. And it's an incredibly jarring, audacious, and disruptive metaphor. But when you stop to think about the way in which this Exodus narrative flows, it's almost as clear as day, even though, for those of you who've been around me know, I don't like to say that the Bible's clear on anything. But anyway, this is pretty darn clear. Let's start with the very beginning. The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, they are vigorous. That word vigorous is the word chai. For those of you who know the word chayim, for those of you who know the word etz chayim, the tree of life. It is not just that they're strong. It is that in those women is life. This is huge. Why? Because Eve, back in Genesis, is a derivative of the same word, chaya, to live, to be alive. The midwife said to Pharaoh, listen, why didn't you do what I told you? The Hebrew women, they are full of life. Almost in a way of saying, Pharaoh, you think you've got enough power to displace the vigorous life, the fullness of life that exists within these women? Before the midwife can then come to them, they have given birth. So God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. The midwife story begins and is honestly slightly disconnected from the Moses character because it's setting up a preamble. Get ready, we're entering into a delivery room, people. There is something that has been conceived. There is something that is gestating within the nation, within the people. And get ready, it is about to burst forth. It is about to come about. Take a look at all of the other themes of birth and pregnancy and life that are found through the very beginning. The narrative goes on to say a Levite and his wife birth a son. That child is then placed into a surrogate womb, into a basket, into a teva, to also then be cared for. Because that surrogate womb is going to cause this child to then be adopted. And the irony, the great irony of the story is that his natural sister is going to become the nursemaid. His mother then becomes the wet nurse. And Moses is then adopted by a foreign daughter of the king. Now, this name Moses is very fascinating. It means drawn out when you take a look at the Hebrew phraseology. In fact, that's what your biblical narrative wants to share with you. Scholars have debated this for a long time because that word, Moshe, does mean draw, but is it really fundamentally a Hebrew word, especially when adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, who most likely speaks Egyptian? When you then do that kind of scholarly work, you see that Moses' name actually in Egyptian does not mean drawn out, means born or the son of, and is the same root that is found in a lot of the kings of Egypt, such as Thutmose, Ramses, and Akhmose. And what's fascinating is Ra Moses kind of means the bad Moses versus the good Moses in Hebrew. The narrative goes on to describe this conflict, this great tension that Moses has, both first with God, with his brother Aaron, and then ultimately with Pharaoh. You know the story as the 10 plagues. But I would propose to you that there's something really interesting about the way these plagues are developed. First, it starts with blood, which some have suggested might be the very first period of a woman during her age of maturity in order to then become pregnant. And then we have 9 plagues for Egypt. And those 9 plagues end with a stillbirth for the Egyptians. Whereas those 9 plagues end with a brand new life and of Israel being born again. Scholars have noticed that the word for Egypt does mean bondages, but in other places, like in Psalms, the word Egypt, Mitzrayim, actually means a narrow place, which may be a hint, a clue, another metaphorical symbol and picture of passing through the birth canal, which is made explicit because for those of you who know the story about Passover, what do they place on the lintels of the door after they sacrifice the lamb? They place the blood. So Israel passes through a narrow place of blood and of water. My friends, I'm going to propose to you that this Exodus story is a birth narrative. It begins with the midwives, and all of the drama and all of the development and all of the chaos and all of the wrestling and all of that could be seen and understood as the contractions of giving birth to something new. And these little hints and these little clues have been commented on by commentators throughout the ages, which is why the Exodus story is the beginning, so they say, of the birth of the nation of Israel. So, question, if Exodus is a birth narrative, is Moses really the principal character of the story? Because this story begins with Shifra and Puah, and then Miriam, Moses' sister, Miriam's mother, Pharaoh's daughter, the number of women that understand the critical importance of this child is explicitly screaming off the page. And without these women, Moses doesn't exist. Because the narrative is subtly and subversively telling us it is the women who know how to birth justice. They know what it is to bring a child into this world in that kind of regime. They understand. They have the knowledge, the wisdom, the insight, and the experience to bring forth justice. It makes perfect sense if Exodus is a birth narrative that you start with Shifra and Puah. And if that is the case, we can extend this metaphor even further. If Exodus is a birth narrative, this makes Yahweh God a mother who's giving birth, Egypt as a womb, Israel as God's child, and Moses not as the great savior, but Moses as a midwife of the children of Israel. Consider that image for just a second. for all the movies that you've seen, for all the posters of Charlton Heston, for all of the grand cinematography of who this Moses character is. Have you ever considered Moses to be the next reflection or iteration of what the narrative is attempting to share with us? Shifra and Pua know what it's like to demonstrate civil disobedience. Shifra and Pua know what it's like to be cunning and savvy and wise. Shifra and Pua know what it's like to still protect life in the midst of a horrible regime. Moses, get on board, would you? Can you catch up to the story? And he eventually does. He becomes that character. But he essentially plays that opposite side as a midwife. This story, by the way, for those of you who might find this offensive, I know gender and theology continues to be a contentious issue. I hope that over time at Spark, we can begin to lay a lot of that to rest. We have clearly seen that gender, male and female, feminine and masculine, are fully encompassed in what the divine is. And it should be no surprise to us when we find stories that hint, refer to, or explicitly illustrate the various gender expressions of who God is. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you. You forgot the God who gave you birth, Deuteronomy 32 says. Can a woman forget her nursing child or show compassion for the child of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you, says Isaiah 49. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bonds of love. I was to them like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and fed them, says Hosea chapter 11. A God who leans down to breastfeed his child, her child, its child, God's child. So that's why I think this random sparker wants to state explicitly, it was a group of girls and women that led to the downfall of the empire and the liberation of Israel and the beginning of a whole new nation. It was them. Those women knew how to birth justice. And it is a minor or major tragedy, depending upon your perspective, that we have completely lost our view of those women. And when we think about Moses, when we think about Exodus, we think about Moses. Now, when you think about Exodus, I want you to think about Shifra and Pua, Miriam, Jochebed, Zipporah. I wish I could spend the next hour just reading to you excerpts of Richard Tarnas's book, The Passion of the Western Mind. It's one of the most brilliant books that I recommend to people to describe how in the world did we get here. What were the conceptions and the ideas that shaped who we are, how we think? Towards the end of his book, in the very last dozen or so pages, Tarnas takes some time to describe, so what is the sum of all of Western history after we've gone through Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas and Augustine? He just goes through the entire series of history and describes what has brought us here and what really is the challenge, what is the passion, what is the crisis? And he begins to pontificate and articulate that at the core being of Western civilization has been a wrestling, a tension, a struggle between the masculine and the feminine. And throughout history, you can see this struggle playing out through dominance versus nurture, through control versus care. He writes, the crisis of modern man is essentially a masculine crisis. And I believe its resolution is already now occurring in the tremendous emergence of the feminine in our culture. An epochal shift is taking place in the contemporary psyche, a reconciliation between the two great polarities, a union of opposites, a sacred marriage between the long dominant but now alienated masculine and the long suppressed but now ascending feminine. What is happening, so Tarnas writes, this is back in the 90s, is that a radical shift of our consciousness is happening. And he's suggesting that what is happening is that we have alienated masculine and feminine from one another, and the next shift of our humanity is bringing them back together again. My one quibble with Tarnas's argument is that he thinks that this is happening now in the modern age in contradistinction to the ancient civilizations. My one quibble, the authors of Exodus were way ahead of us. They knew and they understood. They wrote about male and female together being in the image and likeness of God. They wrote about heroes and heroines. They wrote about men and women and children together usurping unjust empires to bring about God's kingdom. And the Exodus, my friends, I propose to you, is just simply another example. It is a birth narrative. It is therefore also a justice narrative. And as a result, it is therefore also a feminine narrative. Pharaoh plays the predominant role of the masculine male. These women, these girls, play the role of the fiercely attentive, determined, savvy, compassionate, and kind feminine. And that narrative should not be overlooked because it is core and central to what is happening in the thrust of the entire narrative and story of our faith. Now, I want to be absolutely clear here. This is not about men versus women. This is not about whether or not a man should be suppressed or a woman should be elevated. That is not what this is about. Because as we will see in the story and as you will observe, both men and women exemplify both feminine and masculine characteristics. It is available to us all, because it all lives within us. The Exodus is a birth narrative. The Exodus is a human narrative. I wrote something that I'd like to share with you that I think sums up the principal message of what this Exodus story is going to share with us, especially at this very beginning portion here. I hope you find it inspiring. Masculine dominance, control, exploitation, self-determination, ego, rationality, strength, and power has throughout history suppressed and repressed the feminine. Nurture, nature, communalism, partnership, mutuality, emotionality, imagination, and intuition. This imbalance wreaks havoc on the world. The great dilemma of the human experiment has been and continues to be righting those wrongs, the injustice of that imbalance, to bring into reunification the fullness of the image of the divine into all aspects of our human affairs. In this story of the Exodus, we see the clear determination of the masculine in Pharaoh, pride, ego, coarse indifference, power and control. And because we have been conditioned by Western theories of conflict, we see Moses as the masculine foil, the equal counterpart to the dominant male Pharaoh. Upon closer inspection, however, without the women, there is no exodus. There is no redemption. There is no liberation. There is no liveliness. There is no fruitful and multiply. There is no salvation. In brilliant ways, these minor, quote, minor characters demonstrate the power of masculine and feminine reuniting as one. Moses is the complete opposite of masculinity. He is fearful, he lacks initiative, he's deferential, and he's cowardly. He is weak, he's uninterested in being a hero. He is emotionally imbalanced. At times, he lacks conviction, and he commands nothing. The women, on the other hand, as feminine characters command masculine attention. They demonstrate resolve, participate in civil disobedience, exemplify strategic cunning, and are fiercely determined to the core mission. They subvert the status quo, all without compromising their ability to nurture, protect, and guide. The great poetic and ironic narrative of Exodus is demonstrably disruptive, depicting the women as dominant leaders and Moses as an attendant midwife. The lesson is clear. Justice is realized when the two are brought together, which, just as in biological terms, results in a birth. The emergence of new life from the unity of both the masculine and the feminine. This justice emerges out of and into an imbalanced masculine dominance, Egypt, the narrow place. It is for this reason that an emphasis on the feminine is necessary, not to maintain an inverse of the imbalance, to put women on top, but rather to bring both back into harmony with one another, a healing and reconciliation of our fragmented humanity. As such, this ability to birth justice is available to us all, male and female and non-binary. It is found in the mutual recognition that feminine and masculine are not bound to the sexes, a word, by the way, that means division. Instead, masculine and feminine together is what binds us all as one. And that unification is the fundamental moral and spiritual foundation of justice. We all have the moral imperative to reconcile our humanity. We all have the masculine and feminine within us. We all bear the image and likeness of God, the original nurturing mother and father. We all have the capacity and calling to birth justice. This story, my friends, at the very beginning, is calling us to peer into the faces and the eyes of the so often forgotten women of this story. No doubt, there's big things, big miracles, big things that happen in this Exodus story. Of course, the parting of the Red Sea, the feeding of the however many millions of people with manna. But this redemption, this freedom, this liberation, this justice story does not happen, could not have happened, will not happen, had it not been for the fierce determination of these women. Exodus starts with two women, Shifra and Puah, midwives, maybe connected to Moses, maybe not. Get ready, my friends, we're entering into a delivery room. And what happens in there is nothing short of a profound miracle. As we come to our time of communion and we sing this song that Junior taught us earlier, I Choose the Jesus Way, one of the things that we don't have time to explore, which we will get to when we get to the gospel narratives, is that this reunification of masculine and feminine is actually continued on in the Jesus story. And there are multiple examples of how Jesus does not fit the standard quo of what a dominant masculine male might look like. In addition to calling out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, he stops and tells his disciples, consider the lilies of the field. And so as we sing and as we take communion together, I hope that this is not just an Exodus story, it is the entirety of our faith. It is one of the core values of Spark, to take that which was broken and separated and fragmented and reconcile them back together again. I can imagine that some of us don't have to imagine too hard of what it's like to live in that kind of oppressive environment where there's political succession and ignorance and incompetence and fear. Remember Shiphrah and Puah. Remember Miriam. Remember Jochebed and Zipporah. And remember that they demonstrated for us and modeled for us what it's like to birth justice. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." My friends, all are welcome at this table. And not just all of you, but all of who you are is welcome at this table. Please come as we sing.